House Committee and Judiciary come to order. Today is May 28th, 2013. Today we're having a public hearing on the parole of Mr. Porter. And our first panel I'd like to call is Sheriff Jason Myers, Chief Scott Russell, and DA Tim Colahan, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before we get started, I don't know how you and Representative Krieger feel, but I kind of feel at home here today. Well protected.
Well protected today, yeah.
That's better than having the whole room full of attorneys out there.
Please go ahead in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good afternoon, Honorable Committee members. My name is Scott Russell. I'm Police Chief for the City of Woodburn, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police as First Vice President. First, let me thank you for having this hearing and giving us the opportunity to appear before you today. The members of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police stand with our brothers in Eastern Oregon law enforcement today to protest the parole of the murderer of John Day Police Officer Frank Ward. We find it reprehensible that this offender should receive parole at this time and through an improper process. My comrades will ably tell you about the deficiencies in the actions of the parole board in this case. They will tell you about the aggravated nature of this crime and about Officer Ward as a man. Rather than duplicate their efforts this afternoon, let me share with you the impact that a line of duty death has on a police department, a family, and a community. In 1992, I was a young patrolman with 4 years of service when Frank Ward was killed. But I remember being on duty that night. And I remember my sergeant calling us into the briefing room and reading the teletype that announced his death to the rest of our shift. I remember wondering what it would be like to lose one of our own officers that way and how it would impact my family if it was me. In the ensuing 21 years, I've lost a number of friends and comrades and acquaintances in the line of duty. Each one was a tremendous loss to their family, their agency, and their community. 4 years ago, on a cold December night, two officers died in my city as they worked to protect the public. One was an Oregon State Police trooper, whom I'd met only once or twice before. The other was my good friend and comrade for more than 20 years. In fact, he was the sergeant that read that teletype that night so many years ago. But regardless of our relationship, we answered the call to serve and stood together to get the job done. I was badly injured in the incident, was therefore unable to attend the memorial service, but I was able to attend and testify at the trial of their killers. The loss of these officers created enormous holes in their families that can never be filled. Their murders devastated our agency and community. Now, 4 years later, we still work every day to overcome the impact of that crime and to honor their memories by our efforts. As police officers, our families, our fellow officers, and communities count on the criminal justice system that we have dedicated our lives to support and defend to provide justice for all of us as well as the public we serve. When the system fails, as it has in this case, we must pause to consider, will it fail us as well? Will it fail our comrades, our community, our family, if we should stand in Officer Ward's place? The murder of a police officer is different than any other crime that occurs in this state because police officers stand in the place of the citizens of Oregon. Their badge of office represents the sacred trust given us them by the people to protect the peace and protect the public. Therefore, an attack on an officer is an attack on every citizen and on our ideals as Oregonians. Let me close by saying clearly that we do not seek retribution. That will never bring our officers back. We simply seek proper consequence for individual action and thereby some measure of justice for the fallen. Thank you.
Chair Barker, member of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff. I'm also president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of your 36 elected sheriffs. I, too, would like to begin by thanking the House Judiciary Committee for holding this hearing on an issue that is very important to the safety of our communities around the state. Today, you will hear testimony on a decision made by the Oregon Parole Board to release a convicted murderer, Sidney Porter, that is based on very limited information on the facts surrounding the brutal death of a John Day police officer, Frank Ward. While this situation involves a police officer who was serving his community as a peacekeeper, the fact of the matter is this situation could occur to any victim of a crime if nothing is done to change the process our parole board follows. To me, the parole board is viewed as the gatekeepers for determining whether or not eligible offenders can be released from prison. As gatekeepers, the parole board should be carefully reviewing all of the information pertaining to each offender and then making the best decision in the interest of justice and community safety. Through this recent decision by the parole board and subsequent conversations I have had with the director, Jay Scroggins, I have learned that the entire parole board review is driven by process and not by due diligence, pertinent factual information, and a determination of the offender's risk to reoffend our community. To put this simply, the parole board only hears information from a limited number of sources. It could be the victim's family, a prosecutor, and the offender, etc., in each case that it hears. If any of these sources choose not to attend or were not properly notified of the hearing, then the information that would normally be provided by the source is not included in the hearing. Can you imagine making a decision with community safety in the balance without all of the information? This is exactly what happened in this situation. In closing, the Oregon Sheriffs would like you to know that the process the Oregon Parole Board follows and that the decision that was made in this case is very, very concerning to us. While we understand the Parole Board's need to carefully review each situation and to give offenders second chance, that must be balanced by justice, accountability, and the offender's risk to reoffend in our community. The only way that this information can be vetted by the parole board is through a thoughtful, factual, and inclusive process. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Tim Colahan. I'm district attorney in Harney County. I'm also currently serving as president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I was serving as district attorney in 1992, and I well remember the murder of Officer Frank Ward, and I remember the impact that that murder had on the communities of Eastern Oregon and on police officers. In a rural community, officers are frequently put in a situation where they have to make a decision of whether they're going to wait for backup or whether they're going to have to go to the aid of somebody that's in need of their assistance, just as Officer Ward did the night that he was murdered. It's important to know, and I know it'll be explained to you, that this criminal case was not prosecuted by the district attorney of Grant County, and that's not unusual. It's quite often that the Attorney General's Office, the Criminal Justice Division, comes in and takes over more complex cases, which is what happened in this case. Notice of this parole hearing was sent to the Grant County District Attorney's Office, but that district attorney was not in office at that time. That office did not prosecute the case. No notice was sent to the Criminal Justice Division. What that meant was that the office that had been responsible for the prosecution of that case, the office that had all the files, the office that had the most information regarding the case, never received notice of this prosecution. Of this parole board. I hope that this does not turn into a finger-pointing exercise to find fault with those responsible for allowing an obviously insufficient record being used to make a bad parole decision. The procedure should ensure that those parties with information necessary to make such decisions receive notice. I personally am aware of a retired assistant attorney general who, to this day, many years after he has retired, continues to appear for parole hearings in a case that he prosecuted. It was a murder case. So I know that there is a process to allow that to occur. This is a situation where our police officers and all of our citizens deserve a process that is thorough and allows for a thoughtful and intelligent parole decision. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Ferrioli, District Attorney Ryan Jocelyn, and Chief Richard Tirico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted Ferrioli, Senate District 30, John Day, Oregon. First of all, let me thank you for having the hearing that you're having. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. It's something of deep concern to the community, something that I think needs to be highlighted for the community at large. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I probably cannot add anything of substance to what you'll hear from law enforcement folks, folks who are daily asked to risk their lives for public safety. Even though my son is a sheriff's deputy in Benton County, but I do have relatively strong feelings about this issue, and the reason for that is I have read the police reports that were filed immediately after this incident. I have read the dozens of letters that I've gotten from law enforcement, prosecutors, and other interested parties and citizens from across the state, not only in Grant County. I've also read the autopsy report on the officer, and I want to tell you that the seriousness of this crime cannot be understated, and the concern of the community about this convicted killer cannot be understated. He will be released, if there is no further action by the parole board, into Grant County, and that is the place where his victim's family still reside. And there are very strong feelings in that community about the action that happened 20 years ago and the action that happened very recently that will result in the release of what is apparently, from my admittedly inexpert and layperson's determination, a person who's never really expressed remorse and who is, as far as I can determine, unrepentant. There are two stories that attend the crime, neither of which indicate to me that this person understands or internalizes the gravity of the homicide that he committed. Or that other to say, well, I won't do it again, there doesn't seem to me to be the gravity of understanding that you would think would attend a person who beat a police officer to death and was convicted for doing that crime. So I just wanted to show my support for the public safety community, but also just to express for ordinary citizens, this guy's scary. We don't want him as a member of our community. We don't think there's any real indication that he won't reoffend. We think that the decision is made by people whose job none of us wants. I want to make that real clear. I do not wish to serve on the parole board. I thank those that do. I don't know of a situation where there is a precedent for this breadth of community members from the law enforcement and public safety community coming together asking the parole board for something that I think is eminently reasonable. That is to say, please reconvene and allow members of the law enforcement community and others to come forward and share their feelings and concerns about the decision that's been made. And if that doesn't affect the decision in any way, I don't know that that is the issue. The issue is people feel like they were deprived an opportunity to come forward and express their concerns, to show their love for the victim's family and the victim, and to express to the parole board that they are still fearful and still very concerned that that the action that the parole board has taken is apparently beyond question. I don't know of any of us that would say we never make a mistake or don't need further consideration on decisions that we make. But colleagues, I appreciate the fact that we're here. We're bringing public attention to this issue. It's a way for people to express their concern. And I will tell you that I don't know of another incident where the law enforcement, prosecutorial, and public safety community has been so united. And I think that in itself is worthy of our consideration, our note. This is a serious issue. People are fearful. This, again, is, in my estimation, without precedent. Thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer questions after the other panel members who are experts in law enforcement have had their opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Johnson. I'm the district attorney in Grant County. I've been the district attorney there for going on 7 years. My office is a small office. I have one assistant prosecutor, deputy prosecutor, a domestic violence funded position. At the time this murder occurred about 20 years ago, I believe there was just the district attorney himself. And at that time, he did request the assistance from the attorney general's office, and they did step in and prosecute that case. My office was given notice of these parole hearings, although frankly, they came to my office. They were funneled to the victim's assistance portion of my office, and we gave notice to victims and so forth. And being somewhat naive as to the process, I did not attend that hearing. In hindsight, I've looked at the notice and considered what might have happened had I attended. The notice, you folks may be aware, but the district attorney is instructed that I would be given a 3-minute opportunity to make a statement to the parole board. And then also, if the date conflicted with a prior scheduled event of mine, it would go forward as scheduled. So it's a fairly limited role. It's not the typical adversarial process where there's somebody representing the state and somebody representing the defendant. The parole board, as I understand it, is the one who gathers the information and makes the appropriate decision. Had I appeared at that hearing, I don't know what I could have provided beyond what the parole board ultimately received by way of information, but I think it probably would have stated the obvious, which was one, this was a brutal murder of a police officer who was beaten to death after responding to a violent domestic violence case. Mr. Porter was in the process of assaulting his wife when the officer arrived. He was beat to death with hands and then ultimately with a piece of firewood. I think I probably would have pointed out that there never at any point in the process up till then had any remorse or responsibility been shown by Mr. Porter. And then I think I probably, if I was privy to it at the time, which I wasn't but became later, would have pointed out the psychological evaluation that was ultimately considered by the parole board prior to their ultimate decision to go ahead and release Mr. Porter as scheduled in June, which in that psychological evaluation, several things were learned. And let me just digress for a second. I was contacted by many members of the community expressing concern about this. And before I'd seen that psychological evaluation, I said, look, the parole board has a process. There was apparently a psychological evaluation done, and I'm assuming that that evaluation, he checked out, he was good to go, he was evaluated, determined not to be a danger to society, and that must have been what they hung their hat on. Then I got that evaluation. I read that evaluation once. I read it again, and then I checked to see if there was pages missing, because I couldn't believe what was said in the evaluation would be a basis for releasing this individual. But the psychologist who interviewed Mr. Porter indicated he had antisocial personality disorder. This is something you don't fix. He's going to have that condition, that disorder, the rest of his life. He showed absolutely no remorse during this evaluation. He showed no responsibility for his actions. He had some explanation for why he didn't understand that this officer clothed in a police uniform who showed up and announced himself to be a police officer, why he didn't believe that person was really a police officer and that he was just protecting his family. The psychologist went on to point out that Mr. Porter was a medium to high risk to reoffend and that he was, quote, a poor risk for parole at this time. And based on that, at least with that information, the decision to parole him was still followed. And I'm just concerned about that. This is not the type of individual that should have been paroled. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Chief Richard Terrico of the John Day Police Department. I've been employed with the John Day Police Department for 23 years. First thing I would like to do is apologize. I have avoided public speaking for the last 23 years, so please be patient with me. The reason we're here, first, I would like to thank you guys for taking the time to talk to us. I also want to thank the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, and the District Attorney's Association for their help in this matter. What it comes down to is the public safety of John Day and Grant County. I was the arresting officer in Mr. Porter's case. I was a backup officer, arrived after the incident occurred. When I arrived on scene at that point, I dealt with Mr. Porter outside, not even knowing what happened, and staying with him because I had history with him before. With all assaults, he always ran off, and we couldn't find him for 2 days. So after finding out what was happening, taking him into custody, which we had caps done him several times because he was still trying to fight us, I was able to take him to custody. That's when I found out that Frank Ward was laying on the floor inside the residence. At that point in time, we'd been there in domestics before with his wife. That's why Frank was there. And that was the reason I thought the issue was. When I found out that Frank had been injured in this, it hit me like you wouldn't believe. I stayed with Frank until he was loaded into the ambulance at that time. I can't explain what he looked like because he didn't look like Frank. He was so swollen from the head injuries. Everyone says a block or a piece of wood. This was a block of wood. Regular size block of wood. When Frank went in, it was determined that he was ambushed from one corner while he was trying to turn into the kitchen because Mrs. Porter was screaming, "Help me." At that point, he was ambushed. His coat was pulled over his head. He was hit, which broke his nose. And when he hit the floor, he was beaten several times over the front of the skull and the rear of the skull. At that point, you couldn't identify him. It was a brutal, brutal murder. After we moved on, made the arrest, court went through, and then we stayed with the family. And we saw a very happy family, very happy, socialized. His wife, Debbie, was always outspoken, always happy and smiling. To see her change over this incident, to this day, she's not the same person. Giving you a little history right now, I'm going to move on to the facts. Facts are that I don't feel I got proper notification to testify at this parole hearing. When I finally did find out about it, I was told it was a done deal and there was nothing I could do about it. And that's when I recruited the help of the association because at this point, Mr. Porter was a danger to the community before he went into prison. I feel he probably was a danger in prison. And I feel if he's released right now, he's going to be a danger to the community again. And community is my first priority, is their safety. And I hope you guys consider this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jocelyn, help us understand. You were sent a notice of this parole hearing. Is that correct?
Correct.
And tell us how you handled it after that.
Well, the notice comes to my office just as would a notice of appeal or a notice of a post-conviction relief type of hearing. That, and I don't have the details because I didn't personally handle it, but that was somebody in my office administrator or secretary, then provided that to my victim's assistance office, and they gave notice to Mr. Ward's brother, who did appear at the hearing. They actually attempted to contact the wife of the victim. We never could reach her, and that's as far as the process went. It didn't really come across my radar until I was contacted by the police chief, Mr. Harvey, who asked if I was aware of the parole decision, and then we had some discussions, and then I looked at what, found that notice, read it, reviewed it, and so forth.
Follow up. Thank you. So on the notice that was sent to your office that apparently you didn't see when it first came in, is that correct?
Correct.
So did it state that this was somebody who was convicted of murdering a police officer?
I don't believe, no. Those kind of details aren't in the notice itself. The individual's name would be mentioned. It would indicate, I think there's a code on there, as I recall now looking back, there's a code on there that indicates this was an aggravated murder case. It didn't say this is the case of the officer that was murdered 20 years ago. There's not that kind of detail in the notice. But there's a notice. The original notice, frankly, was addressed just to Grant County District Attorney, Grant County Courthouse. We file stamped it. We received it before the hearing took place, but the notice itself gives a list of all of the hearings, parole hearings, to take place within a 2-month block. We actually received the notice excuse me, into that two-month block. It happened to be before the Mr. Porter's hearing, but after several of the other hearings had taken place, so wasn't probably timely received as it was sent, but ultimately we didn't receive it before the actual hearing.
Follow-up, I just want to be clear. So it's a notice of several parole hearings, not a specific one to this case. Is that correct?
Correct. There was multiple hearings, including this case.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Police Chief, how many members do you have for your department?
I'm the only one. We have a four-man department. I can't spare anyone else to go off duty to come with me.
Okay. Senator Farioli, what's the population of John Day?
It's approximately 1,800 people.
1,800 people.
It's a very small, tight-knit community.
Can you elaborate? You hit it a little bit, but a community that small, close-knit normally, a lot of relatives, people that work together. And Mr. Porter is going to have to come back to that community. And he's going to be in a community that's small, as I've said. How is he going to interact or go into a grocery store and get groceries? He can't just stay in the house. He has to go to this community. His interaction with the people in the community, I think everybody says he may be at risk, so people are not going to want to deal with him. But I'm thinking maybe he's going to be at risk to some degree. I mean, people do take these things very seriously.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, the community that I understand he'll be relocated to is about 200 people total. I think he's going to Long Creek. Monument. He's going to be living and working on a ranch. So it may be that initially he'll be relatively isolated, but inevitably he will come in contact with the general public, the general population of Grant County. And yes, there are folks that have very strong feelings about this situation, as there would be in any situation that would be involve a homicide. I think, probably some extenuating circumstances. This was a law enforcement officer responding to a domestic violence issue. He was a young family man with kids. The way in which he was killed was, you know, indescribably violent, and you really don't get the full import unless you look at the autopsy report and the police report, which I'll certainly make available to any member of the committee who wants it. So there are folks who are quite acutely aware of the facts surrounding this issue, and in a community where you have 3 and 4 and 5 generations of family members resident in that community, 20 years is not very much time. So there will be inevitable issues, in my estimation.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions, please.
Please.
I'll start with, I think, an easy one for Senator Farioli. So I didn't know you were coming today. I would have gotten you this question in advance. You know, this committee, of course, is a policy committee. We can certainly make changes when it comes to procedure to try to prevent certain miscommunications or facilitate future communications. However, that's kind of the extent of what this committee can actually do. We don't affect the budget. This is not a budget committee. Similarly, the other, I guess, area of legislative oversight with the parole board would be confirmation. Of course, that goes to the Senate Rules Committee, on which you serve. To the extent you know, can you talk about how this experience will affect how you approach Senate confirmations, specifically with respect to the parole board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, I appreciate your question. It's very insightful. As the senior member of the Senate, having been in this building for more than 17 years, I have personally voted for every single appointee on this parole board. And I assume that endeavor to make sure that people have the role, the appropriate role for the parole board, which is public safety. The job isn't to demonstrate the state's compassion. The job isn't to, make the judgments that on balance do anything other than protect and defend community members from people who have offended. And it is a job that's very difficult, it may be the most difficult job in state government, to be a parole board member. So, you know, I'm concerned that those decisions be made in a sense without undue influence. And you could say that this is putting a lot of pressure on that very issue. However, that being said, I simply would expect the overriding concern of all members of the parole board to be, is this person likely to reoffend? And if there is an indication that they are likely or even potentially a reoffender, then I guess the next issue is, what is the level of violence and threat level for community members? And when you have somebody who will beat a woman to the point where she is screaming, possibly fighting for her life, and then proceed to beat a police officer to death, I don't know how you put a gradient of threat on that action. It is absolutely beyond what most of us ever would have to consider. Those are the two criteria, and I would think that parole board members would be thinking about. Will this person reoffend? What was the seriousness of the crime? And at least in both these instances, I do not see how you could reasonably assume that this is a good decision.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask some questions?
Sure,
this
please.
Attorney, please.
Yes.
Sir, I appreciate your coming in, and forgive me if my questions seem aggressive, but I'm extraordinarily displeased that this has happened. That's understating. I'm downright angry, and I intend to ask some similarly aggressive questions of subsequent panels, but it's only fair, I think, that you accept some scrutiny as well. Having said that, I listened to the hearing, the recording of the hearing over the weekend, and you are correct that all the facts were there. They were there. But I think perhaps what was missing and what might well have made a difference is if somebody were there to actually kind of tie them all together. And I think it could have been done in 3 minutes. I doubt they would have cut you off as you went over. So that said, I think that the absence of law enforcement, of a prosecutor, really was very significant, potentially. And I'm trying to, like, I'm an attorney in private practice. If I had missed a hearing, even if I personally never saw it, but it came through my office, whether my secretary or somebody else, the malpractice claim would be against me. Like, I would have to call the PLF, my malpractice carrier, because I think that would be a reasonable claim. How is your situation any different? Is this not malpractice you committed?
Well, no question, but I should have been there. I won't argue with that. I wish I had been there. I wasn't there. There's not much to say beyond that.
Okay. I suppose you don't have to call it PLF. It's up to the people of Grant County, but I leave that to them.
Further questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, panel, for your testimony. And I just want to note that there's a couple family members who see officers who are killed on duty here in the overflow room. Alan Painter and Kevin Friedenberg are present today, but there was no room in here. Next, we call Ben Ward, Chief Wynn Lohner, and Chief Brian Harvey, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Wynn Lohner. I am the Chief of Police in Baker City, Oregon. I do also want to thank you for your time today to hear this matter. I had the honor today of traveling across our beautiful state with the brother of Officer Frank Ward, Ben Ward, who's seated here with me. And before I turn it over to Ben and let him talk to you a little bit about his family, I want to tell you a little bit about my transformation of emotion that's happened with this matter. And I also want to reiterate something that Chief Tirico said, and the fact that he was not notified of this parole hearing. These individuals in the room behind me representing various forms of law enforcement throughout our state, we have only known, myself and them, have only known about this for just a little over 2 months. We had no notification, we knew nothing about the matter until Ben actually spoke with Chief Brian Harvey of the LeGrand Police Department, who is on the phone right now with us. Told him about the decision, and we brought it up at one of our Central and Eastern Oregon Chiefs Associations meeting and moved this process forward to this point here. So we've had very little time to prepare, very little time to fight this egregious decision. But I want to tell you, when I left Baker City, Oregon this morning, I left angry. Angry at a system that we have in the state of Oregon that would allow this to happen. Angry that the fact that a person that brutally murdered a police officer is only going to serve 20 years of a life sentence. Angry that the citizens of the state of Oregon are going to be put in jeopardy because of a decision that was made, and the evidence was there to hold this person further accountable and to keep them in prison. I was so angry when I left. I'd never met Ben Ward before, but I picked him up in LeGrand on the way over here. And for the next 5 hours, that anger turned into heartbreak. I listened to this man. I listened to about Officer Frank Ward. I listened to the man that was married, who left behind a wife, who left behind twin sons, and left behind a daughter. A daughter that died in her teens from a disease that many say is related to stress. I arrived here absolutely brokenhearted, and I can't imagine what it's to be like for this man sitting next to me, for our community and this great state that we are sworn to protect, because we are putting the most egregious of offenders back out on the street if this decision is not stopped. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Please, Mr. Ward.
Representative Barker and the chairman of the committee, kind of the first time I've really spoke over a mic, other than at church a couple times. really about everybody that's sir, been here said what I really feel.
You identify yourself, please, sir, for the record.
Say your name.
Your full name.
Ben Ward.
Thank you.
I was told last July of a meeting of a committee that he was going to be rehabilitated last July. I took that as okay. I listened to it. I stated my over the phone opinion, and I get a letter later in February that they're going to have another hearing on Sidney Dean Porter. And I listened to it and stated my opinion, and just to make it short, I get a call 10 minutes later and they're going to release him June 7th. Everybody has certain rules and regulations, and I guess I just didn't take this in a way. I just finally got to meet my nephews 4 or 5 years ago because they've been withdrawn from me. They're twins. They just graduated from college 4 or 5 years ago. They finally got a hold of their uncle, and we went and seen him graduate in Crane. I realized through one of my nephews that Debbie, my brother's wife, she went through a withdrawal, just wasn't into it. I mean, life and everything. And my niece, Wendy, he had a daughter, and she was the oldest. She actually took care of my twin, of the twin brothers for about 4 years. And then at the age of 13, within those 4 year periods, and see, I never knew her. I just heard about it. I get a letter from people that I knew in Burns, Oregon. That's where they were from, that she had passed away. That's how I, once my brother, we were going to get together that September at hunting season and really put things together, because he'd been in the service, he wanted to be a policeman, he was into that type of job. You know, there's a lot of things I can say to you all. And I've got a paper here that I read to the board. I'd like to read it to you. But I really feel it's not just my brother, it's police that protect you every day. We've sent people over to war. We got these deals on the car that say support the armed forces. But what about Vietnam? You know, and you look at that, haven't we made enough mistakes? So this situation here can be solved. And I don't hate this person. I'm just wondering, how far do we take it that we don't, you know, police take care of us. Aren't we going to take care of them? You know, I guess through tax dollars. But it's kind of funny. I've been brought up different. I don't get it. I don't even know why I'm here to try to defend something that's pretty black and white. Before I read this, if you pulled up somebody that killed you, your brother, your son, your daughter, and you pulled up the victim that did this, and he's reporting how buff he is and what it reads on here, is he ready to be let out? Twisted women, take him at the age of 30? Looking for a woman over the age of 30 who are sexy, twisted, perverted, and bisexual. This got pulled off the internet just a week ago because his sister heard it. His sister was asked from people that own the land right next to them that's going to take care of them. And his is Dr. Kerr, and he has a place there, Monument, from LeGrand, a friend of mine. He got asked his sister what she thought about this. And she says he was being a naughty boy. He was asked on a DVD what he would do if he got angry and mad again. I'll go chop wood. Now tell me if that guy, I just don't get it. I appreciate a woman who is not afraid to write a sexy letter to me. Description, single, white, narcotic blonde, blue eyes. Nickname, Free the Dean. He even had on the next copy here, and he had on it, he's on a portfolio. It ain't Oregon State Police, it's Oregon State Penitentiary. That's what we're supporting. I believe everybody should have a second chance, a third chance. Did my brother even get a first or second chance? I was told I was a hearing for rehabilitation for Sidney Dean Porter. I thought this was all these were. Okay, fine. Waste the taxpayers' money. Sidney Porter states on how killing the victim, my brother, a police officer, does not agree with the investigation reports at all. I listened to that. That's how I heard that he was killed. And I had to wait 2 weeks later to find out how my brother was killed, what had went on. And a man by the name of Pat Montgomery come to my, because I knew him, had come, and he was a detective on the case. He told it during the last hearing that he just hit his head on the stove. Within 2 months after my brother's death, I was told that Sidney Porter was going to kill a policeman, and he did, my brother. 5 years or more ago, I had come in contact with a person who knew Sidney Dean Porter. I have a business, and a guy walked in with his child wanting to get some work done on some equipment. This person told me that Sidney Dean Porter, before my brother's death, and he'd been in Pendleton, I ended up not even having communication with them here in Salem, and they said go on to Vine after about 10 or 15 years after this. Well, I'm not a computer Buffett man. That if you keep doing these things, you're going to kill someone. He was a friend of Porter's and knew this guy, and I found out, and he told me in my business, he told him that. My niece, my brother's daughter, died at an early age of 13 of lupus 4 years after my brother's death, which was caused by traumatic experience of her father's death. I have heard from many different people. Sidney Porter has been in and out of jail for breaking the law, drugs, etc. That's before this ever happened with my brother. I think that's some chances. Sidney Porter has had his chance before killing my brother and has a second chance after my brother's death, and that is life in prison. I would like every one of you to look at each other that are making decisions for Sidney Porter. What if it was your brother, sister, father, or mother? What if it was your brother, the people right next door to these people, his sister that's on their land, the Kerrs? They have a son that's in the service. There's not been read about the pastor. There was an evaluation about the pastor that he was going to take this on. This pastor that's in Monument has a son that's a policeman. He finally realized everything, and he's not going to take on this person. I'd like to read that letter real fast. But anyway, end his life in prison. I would like everyone to look at each other and make any decision for Sidney Porter. What it was your brother, sister, I think it needs to be let out of prison. Last thing, my brother Frank Ward was a police officer in John Day. He took an oath to protect and serve the people and the community. Does his death, my brother as a policeman, amount to nothing? Does this mean that you and the board make decisions to free criminals or killers after they have killed or murdered a police officer who protects you and your community? What good then is my brother as a police officer? How many chances did my brother get? There is no more chances for him after death. I want to read you what the pastor said in Monument. My name is mentioned in the parole board hearing as one who would like to be counselor for Mr. Porter if he were released from prison. However, I would like my name removed as a counselor or a record, and I am also officially withdrawing my services to counsel Mr. Porter should he be released. After doing my own research and hearing accounts of Mr. Porter crime for individuals and agencies involved in Porter's case, I am personally convinced that he is still a threat to society and should not be released. Some reasons for my decision as follows. Number one, he will be living in the remote location with little or no accountability for most of each workday. Number two, as a result, if he is counseled, many would feel that I should hold him accountable to one degree or another. Number three, in his testimony to the parole board, Mr. Porter did not accept responsibility for crime and does not portray remorse or sorrow over horrific damage he has done to others. Number four, our oldest son is a police officer. Number five, as a law-abiding citizen of the community where Mr. Porter is scheduled to live, I agree with many others of our community that justice has not been served and his release is a dangerous and responsibility to decisions. I basically want you to reconsider this situation. When I first got his deal about Mr. Porter and stuff, he was sentenced for life. I've got it right here, a paper. And then I got another one. He was due, 24, 22. Well, I ain't even going to live that long, or neither of us. So that's basically life. Now, if he wants to be rehabilitated, I have nothing against that. But does he really need to be let out? Is that a responsibility, all of you? I don't want to take that responsibility. And his sister said he could stay there. I hope she reconsiders her statement within a year, because I don't know. Who's going to take the responsibility if he does hurt somebody? His psychic evaluations, he's not ready. I have nothing else to say. Thank you very much. for hearing me.
Thank you very much for coming down. We really appreciate your testimony and know how difficult it have some idea how difficult. I don't have really any idea, but I'm sure it was very difficult for you to do that, and we really appreciate that. Our committee can't overturn the decision, but we're here to try to find out what happened.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And also just want to put on the record that the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Association wanted me to say that they join in law enforcement over the concern about this release. The next committee will be, or now we're going to call Chief Brian Harvey from the LeGrand Police Department and have him testify by phone.
Hi, this is Chief Harvey.
Chief, this is State Representative Jeff Barker in the House Judiciary Committee, and we are calling you now to have your testimony on the hearing about Mr. Porter's scheduled parole.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the call very much and the opportunity to speak to the committee here. Can you ask Derek to turn that down a little bit? Or maybe it's mine, sorry. I'm trying to turn down the background for you so I'm not echoing to the committee there.
Thank you.
So, I'd like to just go through, and I'll try not to reiterate points that other folks have made, but I did want to. This is a case that I've been pretty familiar with, working with Mr. Ward there, and so I've kind of analyzed the case, listened to the hearing several times, and I wanted to play just a couple of quick excerpts out of the hearing as we go along here. I did want to start off with, I think, one thing that hasn't been addressed, really, is Mr. Porter's version of what occurred and what he told the parole board during the hearing. And I think that's a big crux of the issue that causes a pretty high level of frustration. And I apologize, Sheriff Barker, I want to back up for a minute. In the room with me is Sheriff Boyd Rasmussen from Union County and also Lieutenant Reddington from LeGrand Police Department. I meant to get that on the record also. So
thank
I
you.
Apologize to not doing that. So anyway, Mr. Porter gives a version of the events, and I think this is a lot of what's disturbing to the law enforcement community and Mr. Ward. And in a nutshell and paraphrasing, his version of events is he and his wife are at home, been drinking, they have some loud music and discussion going on, and all of a sudden this strange man shows up in his house and attacks him and sprays him with pepper spray, and he's just defending his family and his home from this strange man. And during this encounter with the strange man, who's in full uniform, by the way, during the encounter with the strange man, he at one point knocks him back and he hits his head on a wood stove, and that's what kills him. Now we know from the case investigation that we have independent witnesses that heard Mr. Ward identify himself as a police officer several times outside. Mr. Ward, once he finally gained entry into the house, identified himself as a police officer and commanded Mr. Porter to get off of his wife, who he was attacking and beating. And then we also know that Mr. Ward actually Mr. Porter beat Mr. Ward to death, both physically with his hands and with a piece of firewood, and the autopsy and medical examiner's reports, search warrants, etc., all factually verify that. I want to put out a comment that to become convicted of aggravated murder, and any of the DAs in the room can correct me, but to be convicted of aggravated murder means that that crime has to be, one of the elements is has to be committed intentionally. I share all this with you because I think it's very enlightening to the parole board's mindset when you listen to the comments of one of the parole board members that is discussing this case. And I'm going to play that if you give me just a moment to set it up, if you wouldn't mind.
Please go ahead. The chief is saying he's trying to locate it. The portion he wants to play in the hearing, and he's apologizing for just taking
a second.
This is
the hearing of the parole board. Is that what we're going to be listening to?
I believe that's correct.
Thank you. Mr. Sheriff, I could ask a question. So we have some material that came from apparently regarding the crime, and I assume that they came from staff, right? Did the parole board also have this material?
I will ask them when they come up.
Okay, thank you.
I would assume so, but I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'm going to put this up.
Okay.
Making notes as you were talking. I believe you wholeheartedly that you didn't mean for this to happen.
Did everyone hear that?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so a parole board member's commenting that I believe you wholeheartedly that you didn't mean for this to happen, yet we know that it takes a committed intentionally element of the crime for this to be, for a person to be convicted. In addition to that, Mr. Porter had filed an appeal in his case, and that appeal was rejected. So he's had the full purview of the courts to address his case. And what that leads me to believe, or at least what the impression is that the parole board takes it upon themselves to determine the accuracy of the court's finding. I really don't think that's the role of the parole board. I think they're far exceeding their scope of their authority in looking at things from that viewpoint. There's also a comment made at one point where it's very difficult, and I won't go through and pull this one up, but very difficult to assess what happened 20-plus years ago. Once again, it's not the parole board's role to assess what occurred. Their role is to assess whether Mr. Porter should be released and if it's met the criteria for that, not what the original crime was. The other issue I want to talk about is, as you've heard, Mr. Ward lives in the city of LeGrand. I have put in a public records request per a conversation with Mr. Jay Scroggins, who advised me to do that, to get a copy of the psychological report on Mr. Porter. I wanted that for the purposes of doing a threat assessment for Mr. Ward in the event that Mr. Porter's released. That request went out April 1st. The parole board has refused to respond to that request at all. I think that's just an absolute disservice to not even respond one way or another when they recommended that I put in the request for it. I'm going through some different points here. You've already heard Mr. Ward read a letter from Pastor Ron Schaefer talking about his unwillingness to provide counseling. In the hearing, they talked pretty extensively about Pastor Schaefer being the person who's going to be counseling and helping hold him accountable. My question to the committee and to the parole board is, do they ever verify any of these information about post-prison plans for supervision and accountability for these people? Do they verify anything, or they just take their word for it? Whatever the inmate tells them or whatever the inmate's family tells them, and that's apparently is valid information, they just go with that blindly without verification, because clearly nothing was verified to see if this was truly going to happen, and obviously it's not. So now we have a higher level of concern about Mr. Porter's supervision, accountability, counseling, continued assistance with reintegrating into society. Doesn't have that support that they claimed he would. I also have information, and I've spoken to some of the neighbors of where Mr. Porter is being released. I've had them literally contact me and ask for safety advice. They're very, very concerned for their personal safety. They're in an extremely remote area with very few resources law enforcement-wise. In fact, the response time's probably a good hour to anyone from law enforcement if they needed assistance. So they're very, very concerned. It's another thing that caused me a lot of concern when you listen to the hearing is that one of the board members, and I apologize, I can't tell you which board member said what because it's not clear on the tape who's who, but one of the other ones commented, and I quote, "I was not completely comfortable today with your inability to talk about your prevention relapse plan until it was pulled out by Mrs. Weaver." And I can pull that off the tape also if you'd like. But I listened to that, and here's a person who has not taken responsibility. He tells a story that's not based on the facts as to what's happened. He can't now talk about his plan convincingly or intelligently, talk about his plan and how he's going to relapse into violent behavior, and yet they still decide to release him. And the parole board member themselves is commenting on this, that they're not comfortable with his plan. You've heard some discussion about the psychological exam. And one of the comments here, this is the last bit that I'll play for you, and if I cue it up a little bit, you'll hear a little bit about them talking in the hearing about the psychological exam. Let me give you just a second. I'll pull that up, Mr. Chair, with your permission.
Please.
Okay.
it's a pretty controlled environment out there. You're going to come across by yourself results.
Well, I'm just trying to get an exact
Especially in terms of how stressful things are going to be when you get out, and you can't, the only thing you can control is yourself. So here it's a pretty controlled environment out there. You're going to come across people that are going to irritate you all the time. So the doctor said that you saw yourself as relatively quick tempered, easily provoked. You didn't see any reoccurring problems. But he says that your responses suggested an acknowledgement of important problems and perception of need for help in dealing with them, but the nature of some of those problems would suggest that treatment would be challenging with a difficult treatment process and the probability of reversals, and that that you may have a difficulty with the treating professional as an authority figure, and that you could react to a therapist in a hostile or derogatory manner.
And I'll let it there. I think you get the point. And we've already heard testimony, and they've already commented in an earlier part of the hearing that the results of the testing show that he was a moderate to high risk of reoffending. This is from a professional psychiatrist or psychologist that is licensed and trained to do these type of assessments. I think his assessment's probably right on from the red flags I see in listening to Mr. Porter's version of events and his lack of taking accountability for himself. I can assure you that DOC will most likely probably provide you with some type of assessment they've done internally. And I'd just like to remind the committee that our parole board through DOC, I'd like to remind the committee that those typical internal ones done by DOC guidelines are typically staffed by employees who don't have the near the degree of credibility and licensing that a professional psychologist does. And also those decisions in an inmate setting are done in essence in a vacuum. They are done in a best-case scenario without field conditions and probably aren't very accurate. Our experience in the field has been that there's a huge discrepancy between what their determination are and those screening tools in the prison and what we find out on the street in dealing with these folks when they come out. So I just want to talk about some of the technical points there as we go through this issue. And I think I wanted to close. I'll see if Sheriff Rasmussen or Lieutenant Reddington has any comment here in a moment, but I wanted to close with one of the things I've learned. I've been in this job 27 years in law enforcement, and I thought it was just me, but the operations of the parole board seem to be mysterious and somewhat cloaked in secrecy. I'm a big believer in our actions should be very, very transparent. When I started talking to people and other law enforcement professionals about the parole board and how they operate and what they do, most of us didn't know. Very few people in the state really understands how the parole board works, and they're not very forthcoming in telling us how they work. And I share that partly because I have to say in defense of D.A. Jocelyn, who inherited a case that didn't occur on his watch, I doubt he would know the significance or the process of what to do with the parole board with that notice. And I guess my last comment is twofold, and one is that regardless of whether we were notified or not, the facts of the case clearly stand on their own independently of any testimony. When you look at the psych test and the comments of the parole board hearings and a lack of Mr. Porter taking any kind of responsibility. And I'm very disturbed that the parole board didn't make any effort to notify the agency that Mr. Ward worked for, purely from a moral standpoint, if not a legal obligation, that they notify the John Day Police Department they're going to let one of their officers murderers go. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues if they have any comments. Sheriff? Lieutenant?
I would just like to reiterate.
Okay, please state.
Everything has pretty much been said.
You need to state your name, Lieutenant. You need to state your name, please, for the record.
I'm Derek Brennington, Lieutenant with LeGrand PD.
Thank you.
And you've heard the testimony from Ben, the law enforcement, Senator Farioli. All of us have the same concern here, and our hope is that there's just some reconsideration of the parole board, that they will rehear this to give us law enforcement the opportunity to send people down there to testify in behalf of the family in this case. And that's all I have to add.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant. Okay, any questions for this panel?
I think the Sheriff Rasmussen, sir, would like to just make a comment.
Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Sure, Sheriff Boyd Rasmussen, chair and committee. I would just add that as a resident of Union County, Mr. Ward deserves at least some defense of his rights and his family. At the end of the day, we all work for the citizens, and clearly the system has failed the Ward family. And when it's time, and now I think the time is here, that as a committee that is hearing this, I believe that we all need to stand together as chiefs, sheriffs, and DAs of Oregon and call for avenues to fix this problem. Clearly, there's a misguided decision when we can have a killer of a police officer considered for release after 20 years. That's unacceptable. And as professionals, we need to make this right for Mr. Ward and his family, and I call upon the committee to assist us in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheriff. Okay, thank you, panel, for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Chair?
Yes.
You know, the last sheriff made a remark. He said the system had failed the Ward family, and I wanted to second that. Mr. Ward, I really appreciate your courage in going through. I'm sorry that you're caught in the middle of this. I appreciate it. Hang in there, please, and thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Springer, State Representative for House District 17. In 1987 and 1988, I was a deputy sheriff in Grant County. I left Grant County November 17, 1988. This atrocious crime occurred just a few months after that. I want to tell you a brief story. First of all, I'll qualify by saying I didn't even know this hearing was going on today, which is fine. This isn't my committee. I'm usually not on judiciary matters. And as I walked by somebody's screen, they were saying what was going on, and they said the parole board is considering the release of Sidney Dean Porter. I said, well, that's not going to happen. And clearly, I was wrong. I'm aghast sitting here today when I heard this. That's why I sent you the note, Chair Barker. I've got to testify. I've got to tell a story on this. The fact that this parole is even considered is the most offensive thing that can happen to a community, but more importantly to a family. It was the fall of 1988, it was football season, and we were looking for somebody one night, and let me set the stage a little bit in the 80s, and well, in the 80s in Grant County. I was the deputy. There was a sheriff, there was an undersheriff, and there was me. And I'm not too big. And in John Day, I believe there were five officers at the time, and there's still a fairly decent state police presence. That means maybe one or two at a time, and then a fairly good game division. And I don't even remember what the crime had been, but the John Day police were looking for Sidney Dean Porter. And you knew not to look for Sidney Dean Porter by yourself. And the majority of the arrests I made in Grant County were by myself. But there are a few names in cop circles. You don't go by yourself. It doesn't matter that you're 5'2", 125 pounds, or you're 6'5", 250 pounds. You don't do it because you know the personality of the person you're arresting. It was just a known fact. It wasn't fabricated. It was a fact. And so we go looking for him, and I was young and dumb and 22 at the time and wanted to impress all the old-timers that were there forever because there was this big deal made of the female cop. So I went looking for him, and I thought, nothing better I could do than to bring Sidney Dean Porter in by myself. And we can laugh at that now, and I sometimes do. That was close to the dumbest decision I've ever made in my life. So I go looking for him. Again, let me set the stage for you and allow you to understand what was going on at that time. We didn't have portable radios because they didn't work, so it wasn't worth carrying them. We had radios in our cars. This wasn't Mayberry. Had radios in our cars, and they worked in a lot of the county, but not all of the county. They did work in this area. So I go looking for him, and I go down Canyon Creek, the creek there, and I'm walking the creek bed because that's where he would go. It would just make sense being from that area. And I'm walking down there, and it's dark, and it's late, and I keep walking, and there was just this sense in my spirit saying, you know what? You're far enough now, they're not even going to hear you scream for help, and you sure don't have a radio. And I turned around, and I went back to get a radio. I thought the dumbest thing I'd ever done in my life. Run back and get the radio. Keep in mind, everything is so small around there in the town. So small. Run and get the radio. I come back. It wasn't 5 minutes. And I show up, and here's Sidney Dean Porter in handcuffs with, I think, three or four local guys. Actually, it was a bunch because it was a football game. So there were about five of them there, Grant County and John Day. And my first thought was, dang, I didn't get to arrest him. That would have been so cool. And I walked up to the group of them, and he looked me square in the eye, and he said, you almost had me, and I'm glad you didn't find me. I don't know what that means, and you don't know what that means. That's not a mistake. That's intent. That's evil. And I don't know how anybody could consider releasing somebody that behaves in that manner. That was before the murder. And I stood there with 300 to 400 brothers and sisters in uniform at Officer Ward's funeral, at Frank Ward's funeral, and it was one of the sickeningest things I have ever done. How can this even be considered? His twin sons have paid the price and will pay it for more than 20 years. His wife will pay the price for more than 20 years. Why should Sidney Dean Porter only pay the price 20 years? I'll certainly entertain any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I'll call Jay Scroggin and Christine Wings. Wingus Yannis, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Jay Scroggin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Parole. I'm going to talk just a little bit. We don't have a presentation for you, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about the process and some of the things that have been talking about that have been spoken today about that process. So, regarding Mr. Porter, just the timeline here. This is a process that the Oregon Board of Parole started in May this month last year, and that was with the first process. That was the murder review hearing. There's three hearings that happen when we have someone who's on aggravated murder with a minimum of 30, the first being the murder review hearing. That's a hearing that basically the parole board, after that hearing, if the inmate is found likely to be rehabilitated within a reasonable amount of time, that inmate essentially moves from the life without parole into the category of life with the possibility of parole. That hearing happened in July of last year, and the notices started going to the Grant County District Attorney's Office in May of last year. The notices went out to the victims in this case. Those are the two people that are identified in both statute and rule that the parole board has to give notice on to participate in our process. Six notices were given to the Grant County District Attorney's Office for that hearing. If you have the packet in front of you, you can see the spreadsheet. I don't know of any other hearings that Grant County has, but it was just the one hearing on there. Following that process, he was found likely in July. That was done by a different board, by the way, than the board that is before you today. We then set up for a prison term hearing. Prior to 2010, the parole board used to just say to the inmate that we'll see you in 10 more years for that release hearing. Very monumental case called Fleming-Janowski versus Board of Parole, where we were the defendants, said that if you're found likely at the murder review hearing, that we have to go ahead and impose a prison term based on the matrix guidelines that are that were in place for the crime commitment date of the inmate in question. That prison term hearing happened in November of 2012. Again, another six notices were given to the Grant County District Attorney's Office without a response. The victims were notified. That process, the board imposed the maximum range for the grid that he fell into, The parole board also found that there was aggravating factors and imposed another 6.5 or so years, giving him 254 months, which established a parole release date of June 7th. We had the hearing a good 6 months prior to that. That is the exit interview hearing. Again, 5 more notices sent to the district attorney's office. Notices were sent to the victims. The victims, like in the murder review hearing, responded and came and testified in that hearing. That brings you up to present. He was found. The parole board felt like he met the burden to be released, and here we are today. So that's just kind of some of the timeline. We're not talking about one hearing here. There is a 3 hearing process that took for the better part of this year. Our rules and statutes don't allow us to contact police officers in this case. For instance, about a month prior to the Porter case, there was a case named Kessler. Kessler is the individual who murdered the or attempted to murder the Rocky Butte correctional staff at the Rocky Butte jail in Portland. Again, we notified the DA. The DA took it upon himself to gather corrections officers, show up at our hearing so that they could participate. That's all I have about the process. I thank you all for allowing me to meet with a lot of you, and I want to also thank you if you've taken the time to listen to that hearing. It does clarify a few things. It may not change your mind on this issue of release. But I just want to, I'm basically here for the, I'm the process guy, so if you, without turning it over to Ms. Winges, Giannis, is there any questions that I can answer for you?
And I have one in this process. So in the process, is there any chance of having a rehearing of this matter?
At this point, no, there is not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scroggins, is the Department of Justice ever notified in cases where they prosecute?
No. If you go to the very last page of your packet, you'll see just a copy of the court order. That's our process. We go grab the file, we look at the court order, and by statute and rule, we are to notify the county that the case is out of. It's up to that county to either notify Department of Justice or whoever else that they want to have testify on their behalf. I'll also point out that district attorneys get 15 minutes to testify, not 3.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
You may.
So if when you notify the DA, is it the sitting DA or the DA that prosecuted, or are you allowed to notify both?
Just the office. We notify the district attorney's office that prosecuted the case.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Officer Representative.
Well, I was confused by what I thought I heard you say. The statute or rule preclude you from notifying other people? Is there a difference between what you're allowed to do and what you're required to do in the notice?
I would have to refer to Chair Winges-Yanez on that issue. I'm not sure of that.
I'm Kristen Winges-Yanez. I'm the chair of the parole board. Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I don't believe that the statute says we cannot contact them. When the notices go out to the district attorney and to the victims, they are contacted by our staff. We have a victim specialist and the woman who runs our hearings. And what they base it on is the folks that have registered as victims with the Board of Parole. Anyone else who has requested to be notified, and the district attorney of that county. They look at the judgment. The judgment doesn't say what the facts of the crime were. It doesn't say who the victim was. And it says the name of the prosecuting attorney, not what office pays their salary. So what we have is a process where we follow the statute by notifying the district attorney and the victims who have requested notification. Anyone can request notification from the Board of Parole, and we will send those notices. We notified all the people who requested notification here.
Thanks.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Representative Garrett asked the first question I have, but a second question I have is the answer really quickly to the chair about an additional process. Can you explain why not?
I'm sorry, Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, I'm not sure if I understand your question.
Mr. Chair, I'll clarify. Chair Barker asked, was there any chance of having another hearing? And the answer was no, and I'd like
answer
to know why.
Is no. The board has already considered whether to reopen this hearing. The board received a letter from the several organizations as well as District Attorney Joslin. He presented a statement which was similar to the statement that he made today. The board did consider that, carefully evaluated it, and decided that there was not a compelling enough reason to reopen the hearing. That decision has been made. If you're interested in the thinking behind that,
yes, go ahead.
Absolutely.
All right.
But Mr. Chair, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
So I just want to clarify then, it's the board's decision here that we're hearing. It's not by rule, it's not by any kind of statute that you can't have another hearing. It's your decision.
The board does have discretion of whether to reopen a hearing. However, to understand the board's decision here, it's important to understand the very unique system that Oregon has when it comes to parole. At some point, when inmates, the crime commitment date of Mr. Porter's crime was 1992. An inmate can request a murder review hearing after 20 years. What Mr. Scroggin was explaining, which was the Janowski-Fleming decision, means that if that offender is found likely to be rehabilitated after 20 years, which is his right to request a hearing at that time, then the life without parole sentence is converted to life with parole, and we must, under that law, go forward with a prison term and set it out as he described. So inmates in our system have the ability to appeal our decisions. And like the Janowski-Fleming decision, often those court orders are not what the board wants to see. They are dictated by the courts, not by board decisions. So one of the ideas that we pay very close attention to is the idea that we do not want our orders to be challenged as an arbitrary agency action. So what that means is it takes an incredibly high threshold, new evidence, a disciplinary violation that's occurred for the board to reconsider a decision, because our decisions must be final. If they're not final, then inmates can say, well, hey, what about me? Why don't you reopen my hearing? I wanted my mother to come testify. I didn't know that she could testify. Please reopen my hearing. And if we don't do it in his case, there's a possibility that we'd be facing a challenge on that. I'm not saying that challenge would win. I'm not saying that. But that is generally the thinking behind why board decisions are final. And the board did reconsider this very carefully. I assure the members of the committee that we take this situation very seriously. The board did follow the procedure and the law here. A decision was made. The victim was at the murder review hearing as well as the exit interview hearing, and the board is very grateful that he engaged in our process and care very, very deeply about the statements that were made.
I just would say, you're a woman. Here's this guy who was beating his wife. The police testified they'd been there several times before. He's beating his wife, kills a police officer. And now he's going on Facebook saying he's looking for a woman over the age of 30 who is sexy, twisted, and perverted, and bisexual. Does that sound like that's going to be a good citizen to be out there with the women of Oregon? As a woman, I'd like you to tell me that, answer that.
Chair Barker, as a woman, as the chair of the Board of Parole, I don't like the way that sounds. No one likes the way that sounds. That information was not before the board. That said, the cases that come before the board, these are the worst crimes that happen in Oregon. And we face horrible situations every single day.
Well, you were saying if you had additional information about a new hearing, that would sound to me like that's additional information that could be very important. This guy is, you know, has a story about he tripped and fell and hit his head and all those kind of things. And now that doesn't sound like that's going to be a gentle love story ending to this statement, that what he's looking for in female companionship. And if he finds somebody who doesn't fit that mold as female, he might hammer them into that mold. I'm really concerned about that. That sounds horrific to me. And then to say, well, we've had our meeting, we don't have new information. There's some new information that I would think would be, in hearing the other testimony today, would make it very likely that another hearing would make sense.
Well, Chair Barker, I respect what you're saying. I understand the concern. The board was, we don't like to see that. I'm not minimizing that in any way. But the board, as a body, did decide that that was not sufficient. I will say also that the portions of the hearing that were played today, they were questions that were asked by the board. What was not played was the inmate's response to those questions. Taken as a whole, the board takes that testimony and evaluated and determined that this inmate did display remorse. I'm not saying this is a good person. I'm not saying that we're minimizing his crime in any way. The question before the board is, does this person present a danger to society? And the board determined that he had an emotional disturbance, but that it was not so severe that it could not be controlled in the community.
And could I ask, are any members of the three members of the parole board have the psychological background of the licensed, trained psychologist who said he's a medium to high risk to reoffend?
We don't have a licensed psychologist on the board, no, but we do have a board member who's been on the board for 7 years and has been going through these hearings and has evaluated many of these evaluations. The evaluation is one piece of the information that comes before the board. It is taken in context with the rest of the testimony as well as the record.
Can you give us an example of when you have granted rehearing? I understand it's pretty uncommon from what you're saying, but when does it happen? What are the criteria? What's the threshold?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I've not been on the board. I wasn't even on the board when this murder review happened, so that has not happened in my time on the board. I'll have to refer to Mr. Scroggin.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I know of a couple instances where it does happen. Of course, the most famous is Richard Gilmore. We call it Richard Gilmore 1. The first hearing, that's where, because of process, there was a determination that notices were not properly sent to the victims so that they weren't properly notified. We held a hearing. We then stopped our decision, had a new hearing so that they could come and present testimony. Other instance where it has happened is if something happens from the point of firming up the release date to the release date, for instance, he gets in a fight in the yard or some sort of disciplinary action, we get that info, we will do a new hearing, and the results of that might be to withdraw our last board action and postpone that out another 2 years. I think with what Chair Barker was referring to with this, Not to minimize it, but the Facebook pen pal seeking activity of Mr. Porter, I believe that was a 2009 or 10 that he was doing that. If that would have happened, like he signed up for this since our hearing in February, I think that is new information that we can now maybe do another hearing. But it's certainly information that we can consider. I don't think it's enough of a behavioral issue for us to open it because of how old it is.
So if that had happened, within the last several months, that would potentially qualify as new information that would lead to a new evaluation of him.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, it would certainly qualify. It would be up to the board as to whether they ultimately do that or not.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for coming. I know this is really difficult. It's difficult for everybody here. So I'm assuming that the board did have all the information that we have about the crime that was committed, the murder?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, I'm not sure what information that the committee members have. The board, by law, is limited to looking at what is put together in our packet. The information that the board had about the crime, again, by statute and by our rule, is the pre-sentence investigation. And that was the detailing account of the crime. We did not have police reports. I certainly didn't have an autopsy report. Those typically are not the records that come before the board in this hearing. It certainly is something that district attorneys have brought to the attention of the board when they testify at the hearing. They'll make statements about that, but I'm not sure, again, what you're looking at, but if it's a police report, that it's not in the board's record.
follow up, if I may? Several questions. Thank you. So, I mean, it was a pretty horrific murder. And so when Porter talked about the police officer hitting his head on something, that, I mean, that was obviously erroneous. I mean, that was obviously a lie, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, the information in the pre-sentence investigation, the record that the board had, was that there was blood on wood, there was blood on the walls, that the inmate had hit with his fists. There wasn't specifically information that the inmate had hit the officer with the block of wood. I can tell you, I questioned the inmate very strenuously about how he hit him, whether he hit him with the wood, and the inmate told the board he hit him because there was a statement that I hit him with everything I had, and I wanted to nail him on that. I was questioning what was going on, and he said that he'd hit him with his fists. He was in a drunken rage. The board didn't find that he minimized the crime. He testified that he hit him with everything that he had, and it is a truly horrific crime. Again, all of the crimes that the board sees are truly horrific crimes. I'm not minimizing this crime. It is a terrible situation, but that is the information that was before this board.
And it was, if I may, Mr. Chair, was sort of perplexing when someone said, the recording we heard, I know you didn't mean for this to happen. I mean, it seemed like obviously he meant for this to happen, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, again, without understanding the context of that question, I'm not sure. It wasn't me that asked that question, and I don't know how that came up. So it's very difficult for me to answer that question.
Okay.
The board is certainly not minimizing this crime.
Thank you. And Mr. Scroggin, so I have a few questions for you, if I may, Mr.
Please.
Chair. So who were the victims who were notified?
If you go to your yellow tab of your packet, we notified, and the victims have to be registered with our office. We have Ben Ward, the brother who was notified, and Deborah Ward, the widow of the victim. Deborah Ward contacted our office back and chose not to participate in this process.
Thank you. I think this may be my last question. So if I'm adding this up correctly, there were 17 notices to the DA. Is that correct?
Yes, there was.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I notice in our packet we have the judgment and sentence, and the crime of aggravated murder was by plea agreement, as I read this. And I'm wondering if the record for the parole board looks different if there are findings of fact by the trial court about what happened. I'm just wondering how, when you get more information, or is it different if there's a plea deal by the district attorney?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, if the record that the board has by rule and statute is the pre-sentence investigation that's created when an inmate is sentenced, and that occurs whether there's a plea or whether there's a conviction. If there's a jury trial or facts, the facts from that trial wouldn't come in before the board, regardless of whether it happened or not. Again, the district attorney will sometimes make statements about what happened during the trial or during plea negotiations, but that is not in the board's file or part of the record.
Okay. And I want to thank you for enlightening us on some of this, because this is why we had the hearing, so we could learn these things. I can't believe that you don't have the information. This guy crushed, and even if what, I mean, we know it's a police officer. If it was Joe Citizen, he beat his head in with a piece of wood, and they don't provide you with that information is absurd to me, and we will be correcting that for the future. I mean, I realize this is, whatever happens here has happened already, but the lack of information that's presented to you to make your decisions on is just appalling to me. I didn't realize that, and I'm, you know, retired out of law enforcement after 31 years, and have been involved in some murder cases, and I'm amazed.
Well, Chair Barker, I absolutely recognize that is a concern. Going forward, the board is 100% committed to improving our process. We certainly, looking forward, want to work with the District Attorney's Association to make our process more available and to engage more district attorneys in our process. We frankly love it when the district attorneys show up to the hearings. It's another voice. And when they we want to make that process as available as possible.
And it makes a lot more sense. I mean, we know Multnomah County is a pretty big, DA's office is a pretty big shop, so they get a notice. They deal with these more frequently because they have more murders, but a small place like John Day, I could see where that could easily, unfortunately, be missed. And Mr. Scoggins has already talked to me and saying he'd certainly be willing to have a new notice form that's much clearer and, you know, really highlighted so that somebody gets the notice, they'll realize exactly what it is. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of questions, but one to follow up on that. And I could be making this up, but I listened to the hearing on Friday, and I could have sworn that I heard you reference the autopsy report in your questioning of Mr. Porter. Am I mistaken on that?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I think you it must be a mistake. I certainly didn't have the autopsy report. If there was a comment made about it, we may have followed up. We certainly, the questioning, our hearings are unlike other states' questions. We go on for an hour, 2 hours questioning. So we may have covered...
in this case, I think three. But
It may have been, but we did not have the autopsy report.
Okay. If I may, Mr. Chair, and first let me thank you both for coming in. I'm sure you are not looking forward to this. I do appreciate your coming in and answering these questions. Let me ask you, if I may, and as you can tell, perhaps from my previous questions of the district attorney and others, I'm displeased by what brings us here today. How is it, let's pretend that you, knowing what you know now, remember I suggested to the district attorney that no one quite pulled all the evidence together. I think it's certainly been pulled together today. If you could vote over again, would you vote differently? Do you still feel you made the right decision?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, our hearings are a process that's dictated by law. The inmates, the victims, the district attorneys get to look at the information that comes before the board. It's due process. I can't go back and question what I would have done had I had information that I've heard today. And this isn't just my decision. This is a board of three. We're appointed by the governor. I can't tell you what myself and the other board members would have done. I think it's impossible to do so.
The reason I ask is, you perhaps heard me earlier. I mean, I talked to the district attorney who and suggested that his missing this dispositive hearing was potentially malpractice. In that case, he missed a notice that he personally didn't know about. He dropped the ball. In this case, as I heard it, and I heard your questioning of Mr. Porter was very incisive. You asked all the right questions. What didn't quite happen is somehow the ultimate conclusion. Somehow it's your judgment that is in question. And that's a very different thing. And I just don't know what, if anything, we can do about this. What can we do? With respect, again, like I suggested to him, I think in this conduct, and again, as Senator Farrelly said, you have one of the hardest jobs in the state. It's very easy for those of us up here to second guess your choices made at the time. And moreover, if you get it right 9 out of 10 times, we only call you in when there's that one time. But respectfully, I do think that your judgment as applied to this case at that time failed to meet the standard of care. And I think that's very unfortunate, most notably for the Ward family. But again, I appreciate your coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question that I wrote down here. Just one thing, I'll respond to Representative Barton, a comment he just made, and he stated it very eloquently, that it's difficult to be in the position to second guess your decisions. However, that happens every day to cops. Only they have a moment of a second or less to make those decisions, and it happens every day. They don't get to 20 years later review what it is they want in the comfort of a chair. And so I think we need to draw a very clear distinction about those two situations. So, and I came in late, didn't know this was going on, which is my bad. That's not on anybody else. It sounds to me like, and please correct me if I've come to a wrong conclusion here, it sounds to me like at least a preponderance of the decision to parole Porter was his answers during the parole hearing. Is that an accurate assessment?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, yes, the hearing is a process to validate the information that's in the board record and to assess the inmate before the board.
Follow-up question, Mr.
Please.
Chair? How do you know he was telling the truth?
Chair Barker,
with
Representative Springer, we don't know. Whether someone's, if I had a crystal ball, it would make this job a lot easier. This is a very difficult job. We don't know. We assess, we trust our judgment. Respectfully, our judgment is what we have here.
Just a brief follow-up comment. And I would agree with that. Nobody knows unless they put them on a lie detector, and certainly that hasn't met the admission, the standard for admission into court. But certainly the evidence is pretty clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I do.
Mr. Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you. What would it take to require you to notify a public safety agency who's had a member involved or actually the victim of a crime that came before you at the parole board? What would it take to make that a mandatory notification, not require them to sign up?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, it would take either a change in statute or at what I think the more workable end, a change in our rule.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further questions at all? Thank you very much. I'm sure, like it's been said, that this wasn't, you weren't chomped a bit to get over here today to do this. And we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the final panel, I'd like to call Bob Herman and Josh Marquis, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County. And I want to really thank Chair Barker for having this hearing because, as Representative Barton said, you are not the body that advises and consents the governor on appointments to the parole board. You don't oversee the parole board. You don't even fund the parole board. And I'm not going to talk. There's much more eloquent things have been said about the victim in this case and what it means to be a police officer. But I've been a prosecutor for almost 30 years in four counties. I want to talk about how unfriendly the parole board process is. And I'm not pointing the finger at Mr. Scroggins. I have personally been at no less than six of these hearings. And yes, we got, DAs got from 3 to 15 minutes. Because you know what? In many times, and I happen to know that in this particular case, the widow of the murdered officer, like so many murder victims, simply has had enough. They can't take it anymore. They do not want to be in a room with the man who murdered their family member. So they, in fact, rely on those of us in the DA's office. Now, frankly, for many, many years, most of these cases are spread out 20, 30 years. DAs like Mr. Herman, myself, Mr. Callahan are relatively unusual in that our tenure is over a couple decades. Most of the DAs weren't there. In fact, in many, many special prosecutions, aggravated murder in Eastern Oregon, it was the Attorney General's office. And I can tell you what these notices look like. They're incredibly confusing. We get dozens and dozens of them. I'm lucky that I've got a couple good victim assistance people. And I have to tell you that the process is hostile. I mean, I was given 15 minutes. I have had one of my deputy DAs in front of a hearing for 10 or 11 hours. While the inmate is allowed to put on more and more and more evidence. It is a, and really I think what we ought to be looking at, I know the committee is talking about other sentencing matters, is we supposedly have aggravated murder. We have a death penalty, life without parole, or life with the possibility of 30 years. What happened to that? Now, I think part of it has been addressed, which is that I won't call it a sweet spot. I'll call it a sour spot that's been carved out by the Supreme Court for murders committed between X and Y. And I had to do one of those last year in front of the parole board, where a lovely couple named the McKinnons were slaughtered in a seaside motel in 1991. A jury gave him life without parole. It was overturned on a hyper-technicality. I personally retried the case in 97. The jurors asked, could they give him the death penalty? The answer was no, so they gave him true life again. His case was overturned a second time. I call the family up. I say, okay, I'm ready to do it. And they said, and I'm sure this conversation happens in other DA's offices, Mr. Marquis, can you guarantee us that this trial won't happen again? I was just about to retry another case, by the way, for the fourth time in Benton, in Deschutes County, so I had to tell them the truth. I said, no, I can't guarantee that. They said, make a deal. We just can't go through it. So the deal I made was two life sentences with 30-year minimums to run consecutively, running from 1991 when the guy was sentenced. So I'm not worried. I'm going to be like, I don't know, 97 when the guy's up for parole. Wrong. Nope. Now I find out that, and I think the people from the parole board told you that just goes out the window. Never mind what the judge said. I mean, I think we can all agree, Democrats, Republicans, liberal, conservative, we want truth in sentencing. We want the words that come out of the mouth of the judge to bear some resemblance to the sentence served. Not 30 years becomes 20. Not life becomes 19 or 17. And that's a problem. That's a huge problem. And I, and as many of you know, I am direct and probably at reaching the pinnacle of my political career because of my bluntness around a lot of these things. But the fact of the matter is that the people we appoint to the parole board are very, very important. My state senator raised concerns. The parole board is, as the chair noted, almost brand new. Two members were appointed by the governor. None of you are on the Senate. None of you are on the Rules Committee. But frankly, I think some more attention needs to be paid to that because I've been going to parole hearings for 20 years over different people in different rooms, Mr. Scroggins' role and the chair's role, and it's a very unfriendly process for the victims or for the district attorneys. I'm very careful never to say to a family like the one that was just here, I know how you feel. Because you know what? No member of my family has ever been murdered or raped. So I try to say, I have some idea what it's like, what you're going to go through. And I try to warn them what it's going to be like. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sure Mr. Hermans has some to add.
Mr. Herman, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County, and I don't know if it's a privilege or not, but I've been doing this for about 38 years. I've been the district attorney for 15 years. And as a result of longevity, I have pretty good insight into the very significant problems parole board members have with parole hearings on cases. By definition, these cases are years and years old. I just had one recently that I appeared at on a case that I prosecuted in 1985. What I can tell you is, as a practical matter, the parole board has very little information available. If they have a pre-sentence report, it's not very lengthy. In many cases, they cut back on expenses and stop doing pre-sentence reports in many counties across the state. And so their information is limited, and that's particularly relevant in this case. By nature, their notifications are typically relatives that existed at the time of the crime. They don't include nieces, nephews, children who may have been very young or not even born at the time the case occurred. And so the relevancy of the hearing is so far removed in time that they simply don't have a lot of information. And so they rely on the district attorneys. They give them notice. And I'll tell you, as a practical matter, in many places across the state, there's nobody in the office of the district attorney that was there when the crime was prosecuted. You'll go down to the basement and hopefully find the box with the file and try to re-piece things together. As it happens, uniquely, as I said, I've been around a long time, so I've actually appeared at three or four hearings of murderers, dangerous offenders, even an attempted murder recently that's still in prison, on cases that I prosecuted myself. So I was able to break out the box and pretty quickly acquaint myself with the information. But that is not easy to do, and in this case is didn't occur, and becomes quite relevant to the ultimate decision I think the parole board should revisit. Interestingly enough, before I came here to testify today, I just wrote down a couple notes, not knowing a whole lot about the case at the time. And my notes were things that I look for as the prosecutor on the case: antisocial personality. I look for an expression of sincere remorse, which is difficult to judge in some cases. But I specifically look at whether the offender admitted what they did. Not that they did it or that they should have been found guilty and they're sorry for it, but whether they admit at what they did. And I have found almost routinely on cases where parole has been denied that they don't acknowledge what they did. If there's a sexual component, a murder case, guy was involved, a 13-year-old victim, there was a sexual component that couldn't be proved because the DNA was excluded in 1989 by the judge and the trial was unreliable. And there was no mention by the offender of any sexual component. In this particular case, that is extremely, extremely telling, and I submit that was missed by the parole board members at the hearing because it wasn't available. I think there's no question, I think, from anybody in this room, that law enforcement, parole board members, the public, everyone here wants these hearings to be fair. They want them to be just. They want them to emphasize public safety, and quite frankly, they just want the right thing to happen. Before I heard Mr. Scroggins' testimony, my comment was certainly there must be a mechanism in place if circumstances change to reconsider a hearing, and we know that there in fact is. And the examples I made, somebody assaults a guard after the hearing. They've decided they're going to release him in 6 months. They assault a guard. Certainly there's a rehearing of that case. If offered information becomes discredited, something they relied upon in making the decision is no longer true, certainly they're going to reconsider their hearing. If a community placement that they believe to be critical to a rehabilitation of an offender is, for whatever reason, shut down, it's no longer available, they can't be in that particular treatment facility, and that was critical to the offender's ability, to the inmate's ability for rehabilitation, certainly they must, whether they like it or not, reconsider that hearing. In this case, mistakes were made. But the question is, should mistakes that were made interfere with getting to that just result? We've heard a lot of things that the parole board didn't have available to them. Initially, that counseling support's been withdrawn. This was an intentional murder, a life sentence with 30-year sentence. The Department of Justice is the one that has the files, and I don't know if the prosecutor is still around today, but those files certainly are. And the particular facts of that case, including the autopsy, the nature of the injuries, maybe they need someone in law enforcement, someone with some expertise to explain what the nature of those injuries mean when it comes to an assault. But they didn't happen by fist. You don't fracture the skull. You don't have the brain injury. You don't have the damage that was done to Frank Ward through fists. And you don't have it in the locations in which it was, the nature of the laceration from neck to skull or forehead to back of skull. You don't have it from one fall in the manner in which the injuries were described. There's a lot of information that they simply did not have. And so it seems to me, and I know this body's role is certainly limited, and the purpose of the hearing is limited for that regard. But it seems to me that circumstances have changed. The very fact that they did not have the information that could be provided from the prosecutor or a prosecutor reconstructing the case to show that Sidney Dean Porter, acknowledgement of the crime was nothing more than lip service. He basically acknowledged that it happened, said he wouldn't do it again, and we know that to be lip service because those injuries were inflicted with a block of wood, and it was far more than him just finding someone in his home and reacting. And that, I submit, and this would be my argument for the parole board rather than you folks, is not an indication of someone who's rehabilitatable in the community, or certainly someone who got a life sentence with a 30-year minimum who should be let out in the community after 20 years. Frank Ward was there that day because it was his job. If something happens near Sidney Dean Porter again, a police officer doesn't have a choice. They'll have to respond because it's his or her job to be there. The public deserves a rehearing on this case to make sure the decision is informed, and again, it's the right decision, and Frank Ward deserves nothing less than that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, gentlemen. I guess this is a process question to you, and I apologize to the committee if this was answered or addressed beforehand. So it sounds like the notices were sent to the DA, and I know who the DAs were then, those time periods. They were sent to the DA's office, and it's the DA's office, it's their responsibility to come forward and, I guess, plea their side of the case, if you will, and that did not occur in this case, so there wasn't that piece of information to go on?
One of the problems is that you get so many, you get notices of things that you don't do anything about. You get notices that you're going to get notices. So if you, and Mr. Scroggins, to his credit, came to the last, I think, ODA meeting and tried to decipher it, because it's a whole separate language. And I mean, we get buckets full of these. We don't just get them on murders, by the way. We get them on other people who are on, and what we're trying to do is fulfill our obligations to victims by figuring out whether they want to be notified and then notifying them, oh, by the way. So the critical ones, and there are very few, is, okay, a hearing, like a murder review hearing. That's a biggie. Should we make a decision to release somebody?
Thank you. Brief follow-up. Thank you for your indulgence and patience, Mr. Chair. So it sounds to me like the DA doesn't show up. My goodness, there seems to be a built-in assumption that it wasn't by the parole board, that it wasn't important enough for the DA to come. I would think that there would be some reaching out there. Yeah, the DA dropped the ball, and that was wrong. But I've got to believe that there's a process in place that we just don't go on the assumption that they weren't there to give their side. That just seems to be a very ill-informed assumption.
Sure.
I'll leave it there. And I think that's a process piece we can take. And one last thing. It was mentioned a couple times earlier that with new information, these cases can be reopened. My goodness, there's been a ton of new information today. I would think that would be enough to reopen this and have another hearing.
Chair Barker, Representative Spring, I mean, it's clear, the prosecuting agency in this case was the Department of Justice. They are the prosecutors that had it, and I frankly cannot believe that if you looked at a transcript of it, you would not be able to tell just by the name of who's there. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, there are many small counties where you probably cycled through four district attorneys by the very nature of this. So some burden. We have a heavy burden as prosecutors to notify victims, but I think there has to be some shared burden by the Board of Parole.
Okay, thank you. Representative Krieger.
Well, I would suspect in February you'll see some legislation. We, of course, want you to work with us. But I was just a couple of things. I wrote down, review what information is provided in the sources. Evidently, some of the information, some of the sources isn't provided. They don't even have access to that. And if you don't have access to it, you think that at least they'd ask if it exists. I'm also concerned about cases that are plea bargained down, whether or not these people should even qualify to have a prison hearing about their sentence. We need to deal with that. And then I think the way we need to direct something about how these people are, in fact, contacted. Obviously, there's four or five things here that I think the chair, some of the attorneys, all of this committee would be interested in, and between now and February, of a piece of legislation that would give a lot stronger direction to the parole board how they go about their business. Obviously, this wasn't handled properly.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hicks.
Excuse me, we're losing members because they have other committee meetings.
So I'm trying to talk. So thank you, gentlemen. There's been mention of some factors that could trigger a rehearing decision if offered information becomes discredited, community placement, supervision is withdrawn, the community plan is withdrawn, etc. And I'm gathering that there does seem to be sufficient, in your opinion, reason to trigger a rehearing. So in your years of participating in this process, have you ever seen the court? Have you ever seen or heard of, off the top of your head, the court sort of overturning a rehearing decision on the sort of basis that seems logical to trigger one in this case? Because if Mr. Porter gets, if there's a rehearing now, so the board orders a rehearing, Mr. Porter then says, no, this is not sufficient basis because of da-da-da, that goes to the court, what do you think happens?
Representative
Hicks. Top of your head, I know.
Members of the committee, it would seem to me it would be, unless there's some rule, which I'm told there's not, because you can rehearing if there's a change in circumstances, it would be dependent upon the court's review of the facts that have changed and the information that they didn't have available at the first time and whether that was sufficient. You know, that's relatively basic, but it would seem that would be the criteria, and The court could review that de novo if they felt that that wasn't a sufficient reason to reverse the decision.
Can they do that?
Really?
Well,
I won't put you on the spot on that. That's interesting. No, what we can ask
Mr. Squarg on some other time about
okay.
that.
Okay, I'm going to follow up with that. Never occurred to me.
Okay,
Normie.
Thank you very much, and Senator Farioli, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ted Farioli, District 30, John Day, Oregon. Again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for your indulgence. And I think there's a tremendous amount of learning that's occurred as a result of this hearing. And as a result of listening to this information, I have an ask to make of the chair and members of the committee. I learned a lot of information that's new to me. I think other folks learned a lot about the process and how it's informed. And the request that I would make is that this committee write a letter detailing the new information that's available as a result of your efforts to expand that information. The medical report, the autopsy, the police reports, the procedural issues, and ask that these new bits of information be considered as information that should be available in making any decision as important as this one is. And I'd ask you also to send a copy of that letter to all of the agencies that made their request of the parole board. And I would ask further that you simply make a request that the parole board revisit the issue in light of the new information that's been provided.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further business coming? We're running.
I'll sign.
Committee's adjourned. Thank you, committee.